Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox. It's about 7:30 on Easter morning. It's a little snowy out today. No eggs are going to be getting hit outside today. I was talking with Travis, our oldest, that's still at home here, and saying we should hide the girls' Easter eggs in the shop. It would be a much more challenging Easter egg hunt than if we hit them out there outside or in the house, but they would look like human Q-tips if we hit them in the shop. They'd be so covered in sawdust they would not a good idea. But so today we are gonna dive back into A Fine and Pleasant Misery with Patrick McManus, one of my favorite books of his. Feel like the ones I've been choosing at random haven't been delivering. They're not his greatest works, it seems. I don't pre-read them. When I first started out, I kind of read a bunch of my favorites of his and ones that, you know, that I'd remembered from my childhood and ones that I knew would be a good laugh. But I've been getting some duds here, relative duds here lately. So we're going to read a couple of them today. I'm going to do something different. There's a couple of real short ones. Not real short. I mean, they're, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 pages or something. So they're almost on par lengthwise with his regular ones. But I figured we'd do two and increase the chances of finding a good one. So today, from A Fine and Pleasant Misery, is The Miracle of the Fish Plate. When I was a kid, my family belonged to the landed aristocracy of northern Idaho. We owned the wall we had our backs to. We were forced to the wall so often that my mother decided she might as well buy the thing to have it handy and not all the time having to borrow one. Part of our standard fare in those days was something my grandmother called gruel, as in shut up and eat your gruel. My theory is that if you called filet mignon gruel, you couldn't get most people to touch it with a 10-foot pole. They would rather eat the pole, but when you call gruel, gruel, you have a dish that makes starvation look like the easy way out. My mother shared this opinion. She preferred to call gruel baked ham or roast beef or waffles, as in shut up and eat your waffles. One Christmas when we were hunched against the wall, she had the idea of thickening the gruel, carving it, and calling it turkey. We were saved from this culinary aberration by a pheasant that blithely crashed through one of our windows to provide us with one of the finest Christmas dinners it has ever been my pleasure to partake of, pheasant et gruel. Mom said that God had sent us the pheasant. I figured that if he hadn't actually sent it, he had at least done his best by cursing the pheasant with poor eyesight and a bad sense of direction. In that time and place, wild game was often looked upon as a sort of divine gift, not just by us, but by many of the poor people, too. Hunting and fishing were a happy blend of sport, religion, and economics, and as a result, game was treated with both respect and reverence. In recent years, my affluence has increased to the point I can dine out at Taco Tim's or Burger Betty's just about any time I please, so I must admit that hunting and fishing are no longer economic necessities to me. To the contrary, they are largely the reasons I can't afford to dine out at better places, Smilin' John's Smorgasbord, for example. I still regard the pursuit of game as primarily as a mystical, even religious quest. To tie in a lunker trout is to enter into communion with a different dimension, a spiritual realm, something wild and unknown and mysterious. This theory of mine was confirmed by no less an authority than a Catholic priest with whom I occasionally share fishing water. "Me lad," he said, "whenever you catches any fish at all, 'tis a miracle." I personally would not go so far as to say that my catching a fish would fall into the category of miracles. except, well, yes, there was one time. You might call it the miracle of the fish plate. When I was 9 years old and the only angler in our family, my catching a fish was a matter of considerable rejoicing on the part of not only myself, but my mother, sister, and grandmother as well. There was none of that false praise one occasionally sees heaped upon a kid nowadays. "Oh my goodness, look at that great big fish Johnny caught. Aren't you just a little man?" No, there was none of that nonsense. "Hey," my sister, the troll, would yell, "PF worthless caught a fish. Looks like it's worth about 3 bites," my grandmother would say by way of appraisal, "but it's a dang sight better than nothing." "Put it on the fish plate," my mother would order. "Maybe by Sunday we'll have caught enough so we can have fish instead of baked ham for dinner." The concept of the fish plate may require some explanation. My fishing was confined to a small creek that ran through the back of our place. In those far-off times, the legal limit was 21 trout. Although I'd heard people speaking of limiting out, I never really believed them. It was an achievement beyond comprehension, like somebody running a 4-minute mile or walking on the moon. No one had ever fished with greater persistence and dedication than I, day in and day out, and I knew that it was not humanly possible to catch a limit of 21 fish. 6 or 7, maybe, but certainly not 21. Days would go by when I would not even get a single tiny nibble. I would send 100 worms into a watery oblivion for every solid bite, but every so often, suddenly, flashing in a silvery arc above my head would be a caught trout, usually coming to rest suspended by line from a tree branch or flopping 40 feet behind me in the brush. The notion of playing a fish seemed nearly as ridiculous to me as limiting out. Thus, 1 by 1 and 2 by 2, I would accumulate little 6, 7, and 8-inch trout over a period of several days, reluctantly releasing all fish less than 6 inches, until they were enough for a fish dinner. The collection for these fish was a plate we kept for that purpose on the block of ice in the icebox. It was known as the fish plate. I can say without any exaggeration whatsoever that our family watched the fish plate as intently as any investor ever watched a stock market ticker tape. The summer of the miracle of the fish plate was rather typical. We were living on gruel and greens. The garden was drying up for lack of rain. My mother was out of work. The wall had been mortgaged and the bank was threatening to foreclose. But good fortune can't last forever, and we soon fell on hard times. It was then that we received a letter from a wealthy relative by the name of Cousin Edna, informing us that she would be traveling in our part of the country and planned to spend a day visiting with us. That letter struck like a bolt of lightning. The big question was, what shall we feed Cousin Edna? Cousin Edna was a cultured person, a lady who in her whole life had never once sat vis-a-vis a bowl of gruel. Certainly, we would not want her to get the impression we were impoverished. After all, we had a reputation to maintain befitting the land aristocracy of northern Idaho. After long deliberation, my mother fastened a hard, cold eye on me, which I can tell you is just about as disgusting as it sounds. All we can do is have fish for dinner, she said. How's the fish plate? It's got 2 6-inchers on it, I said. Pooh! My grandmother said, there's no way he's going to catch enough trout before Cousin Edna gets here. That boy's just slow, and he's got no patience, and it's just too damn noisy to catch fish. Why, his grandfather used to go to the creek and be back in an hour with a bucket of the nicest trout you'd ever laid eyes on. As you may have guessed, my grandfather was not one of the country's greatest conversationalists. Although he died before my time, his ghost hovered about, needling me about my angling skills. My grandmother attributed his great fishing success to his patience and silence. Personally, I figured he probably used 1/2 a stick of dynamite as a lure. Don't tell me we'll have to depend on PF Worthless, my sister wailed. We'll be humiliated. I'll catch all the fish we need, I yelled. Shut up, Mom said soothingly. If worse comes to worse, we'll let Cousin Edna eat the 2 fish we have, and the rest of us will pretend we prefer baked ham. It ain't going to wash, Graham said. The best we can hope for is another deranged pheasant. The gauntlet had been hurled in my face. It was up to me to save the family pride or die trying. I dug my worms with special care, selecting only those that showed qualities of endurance, courage, and a willingness to sacrifice themselves to a great cause. By that time of year, I had fished the creek so thoroughly that I had cataloged almost every fish in it, knew them by all of them on their first name basis, and was familiar with their every whim and preference. They, on the other hand, knew all my tricks. It would not be easy enticing them to take a hook, but I was determined to do it. And it was not easy. I knew where a nice 8-inch brookie was holed up under a sunken stump in the grim cold light of first dawn when he would not be expecting me. I crawled through the wet brush and stinging nettles just above his hideout. I waited, soaked, teeth chattering, quietly passing the time by studying the waves of goose bumps rippling up and down my arms. As the first rays of morning sun began descending through the pines, I lowered a superb worm, one blessed not only with dauntless courage but intellect as well, into the sluggish current that slid beneath the tangle of naked stump roots. I knew that I could not retrieve the hook without snagging it unless the point was covered by the mouth of a trout. Never was a finer bait presented so naturally, with such finesse. The line slackened. The hook drifted with the current in the labyrinth of roots. A slight tremor came up the line. I whipped the rod back, and the fat little 8-incher came flashing out from under the stump. He threw the hook and landed on the bank 10 feet from me. I lunged for him and had him in my grasp. He slipped loose and landed in the water, where he circled frantically in an effort to get his bearings. I plunged in after him, hoping to capitalize on his momentary confusion. Unfortunately, the water was much deeper than I expected, and I closed over my head like the clap of doom. Oh my goodness. As I dog-paddled my way into the shallows, I realized that filling the fish plate might be even more difficult than I anticipated the chore would be. Over the next 2 days, I went up and down the creek like a purse seiner. My total take was 2 small fish, and Cousin Edna was arriving on the following day. I had become a 9-year-old existentialist, abandoning all faith and hope, driving myself on, armed only with simple defiance of despair. First, the fish had abandoned me, then God, and now on the final day, even the sun had slipped behind the mountains, no doubt snickering to itself. Before me lay the bleakest, shallowest, most sterile part of the creek. Never in my whole life had I caught a fish there, mostly because it would have been pointless to even try. The water rippled over a bed of white gravel without a single place of concealment, even for the smallest trout. Well, possibly there was one place. A small log was buried in the gravel diagonal to the current, and I noticed that on the downstream tip of the log there appeared to be a slight pooling of water. I eased into the stream and crept up to the butt end of the log, whereupon I perceived that the gravel had been washed from under it to form a narrow trough of dark, still water. I lowered my last worm, a pale, haggard, well-traveled fellow, into this trough and let it drift along the log, bumping over the gravel into limbs and knots until it stopped. Snagged, I thought. Furiously, I hauled back. My rod doubled over, but the hook didn't come loose. Instead, the line began to cut a slow arc through the water, picking up speed and then exploding out onto the gravel bar. Came what seemed to be a monstrous brook trout. I cannot tell you how long the ensuing battle lasted, because at my first glimpse of the fish, time ceased to exist, and the trout and I became a single pulsating spirit suspended in infinity. When at last we emerged into our separate identities, it was as victor and vanquished. In the dying light, the trout lay clamped between my aching knees on a white gravel beach, and I killed him with a sharp blow of a rock to the back of the head. As he quivered into stillness, I was filled with unknown joy, unfamiliar sorrow, and I knew Without the slightest doubt, I knew that under that same log, waiting in that watery darkness, was his twin. Gently, I removed the hook from those great jaws, repairing the tatters of the heroic worm, threading them back the best I could onto the hook, and then made my way back to the log for a repeat performance. When you have a miracle going for you, you never want to waste any of it. The dinner for Cousin Edna was a great success. When it was over and everyone had his fill, there were still large sections of fried trout on the plate, which I suppose I need not tell you was the humble fish plate. "My heavens," exclaimed Cousin Edna, "I just don't know when I've had a finer meal." "It's not over yet," said Graham, and then she served Cousin Edna a heaping bowl of wild strawberries that my sister had picked with her own little troll fingers. The wild strawberries made Cousin Edna's eyes roll back in her head. They were so good. "Why, I hope you're not giving me all the strawberries," she said, suddenly noting our attentiveness. "Land sakes," Graham said. "We have them so often we're tired of the little beggars." I looked at Graham in disbelief. It was the first time I'd ever heard her lie. "We thought we would have some nice pudding instead," my mother said, passing around some bowls. I looked into mine. "Hey," I said, "this looks like, this smells like..." "Hush, dear," my mother said, and her voice edged with granite, "and eat your pudding." All right. The story of gruel is what that one should have been called. So we will jump right now into the backpacker. Strange, the things that suddenly became fashionable. Take backpacking, for instance. I know people who 5 years ago had never even climbed higher than a bar stool. Now you can scarcely name a mountain within 300 miles that they haven't hoofed up in their Swiss-made waffle stompers. They used to complain about the price of sirloin steak. Now they complain about the price of beef jerky, which is about 3 times that of Maine lobster in Idaho. Their backpacking is a refined sport noted for lightness. The gear consists of such things as silk packs, magnesium frames, dainty camp stoves. Their sleeping bags are filled with down of unborn goose. Their tents made of waterproof smoke. They carry 2 little packets from which they can spread out a 9-course meal. One packet contains the food and the other a freeze-dried chef. Well, it wasn't like that back in the old days, before backpacking became fashionable. These latecomers don't know what real backpacking was like. The rule of thumb for the old backpacking was that the weight of your pack should equal the weight of yourself and the kitchen range combined. Just a casual glance at a full pack sitting on the floor could give you a double hernia and fuse 4 vertebrae. After carrying the pack all day, you had to remember to tie one leg to a tree before you dropped it. Otherwise, you would float off into space. Everyone who's backpacked knows that feeling. Holy smokes. The pack eliminated the need for any special kind of ground-gripping shoes because your feet would sink in 1.5 feet into hard-packed earth, 2 inches into solid rock. Some of the new breed of backpackers occasionally wonder what caused a swath of fallen trees on the mountainside. That is where one of the old backpackers slipped off the trail with a full pack. My pack board alone met the minimum weight requirement. It was a canvas and plywood model, surplus from the Second World War. These pack boards apparently were designed with the idea that a number of them could be hooked together to make an emergency bridge for Sherman tanks. The first time you picked one up, you thought someone had forgotten to remove his tank. My sleeping bag looked like a rolled-up mattress salvaged from a fire in a Skid Row hotel. Its filling was sawdust, horsehair, and number 6 birdshot. Some of today's backpackers tell me their sleeping bags are so light they scarcely know they're there. The only time... Oh my goodness. The only time I scarcely knew my sleeping bag was there was when it was 2 a.m. on a cold night. It was freckled from one end to the other with spark holes, a result of my efforts to stay close enough to the fire to keep warm. The only time I was halfway comfortable was when it was ablaze. Oh, man. it was the only sleeping bag I ever heard of, which you could climb into in the evening with scarcely a mark on you. Oh my goodness, I'm sorry. It was the only sleeping bag I'd ever heard of where you could climb into in the evening with scarcely a mark on you and wake up in the morning bruised from head to toe. That was because two or three times a night my companions would take it upon themselves to jump up and down and stomp at my sleeping bag fires in their haste, neglecting to first evacuate the occupant. Oh my goodness, I can't even see through my tears. Since I was a camp cook, I never knew whether... Oh my goodness. Ay, ay, ay. You guys are going to have to fire the narrator here. Get a grip, dude. Since I was a camp cook, I never knew whether they were attempting to save me from immolation or getting in a few last licks for what they thought might be terrible indigestion, terminal indigestion. Our provisions were not distinguished by variety. Dehydrated foods were considered effeminate. A man could ruin his reputation for life by getting caught on a pack trip with a dried apple. If you wanted apples, brother, you carried them with the water still in them. No one could afford such delicacies as commercial beef jerky. What you carried was a huge slab of bacon. It was so big that if the butcher had left on the legs, it could have walked behind you on a leash. A typical meal consisted of fried bacon, potatoes and onions, fried in bacon grease, a pan of beans heated in bacon grease gravy, some bread fried in bacon grease, and cowboy coffee made by boiling an old cowboy in bacon grease. Oh my goodness. After meals, indigestion went through our camp. Oh my God. After meals, indigestion went through our camp like a sow grizzly with a toothache. During the night, coyote sat in nervous silence on surrounding hills and listened to the mournful wailing coming from our camp. There were a few bad things, too, about backpacking in that old style, but I loved all of it. I probably never have thought of quitting it if I hadn't been for all those geophysical changes that took place in the Western Hemisphere a few years ago. The first thing I noticed was a distant hardening of the earth. This occurred wherever I happened to spread out my sleeping bag, so I knew that the condition was widespread. Interestingly enough, my children, lacking their father's scientific training, were unable to detect the phenomenon. A short while later, it became apparent to me that the nights in the mountains had become much colder than I could remember in the past. The chill would sink its fangs into my bones in the pre-dawn hours and hang on like a terrier until the sun was high. I thought possibly that the drop in temperature was heralding a new ice age. Well, I could put up with the hard and the cold, but the air started getting thinner. The only way you could get sufficient oxygen to lug the pack, a pack the size of an adolescent pachyderm, was by gasping and wheezing. Some of my wheezes were sufficient to strip small pine trees bare of their needles. My trail speed became slow. It posed a dangerous threat to my person. If we were in fact on the onset of a new ice age, there was a good chance I might be overtaken and crushed by a glacier. The final straw was the discovery that a trail I had traveled easily and often in my youth had undergone a remarkable transformation. In the intervening years since I had last hiked it, the damn thing had nearly doubled in length. I must admit that I was puzzled, since I didn't know that trails could stretch or grow. The fact that it now took me twice as long to hike it, however, did not allow for any other explanation. I asked a couple older friends about it, and they said that they had seen the same thing happen. They said probably the earth shifted on its axis every once in a while and caused trails to stretch. I suggested that maybe that was also the cause for the ground getting harder, the nights colder, and the air thinner. They said that sounded like a plausible theory to them. My wife had another theory, but it was so wild and far-fetched I won't embarrass her by mentioning it here. Anyway, one day last fall, while I was sitting at home fretting about the environment, a couple of friends telephoned and invited me along on a pack trip they were taking into the Cascades. Both of them are of the new school of backpacking, and I thought I owed it to them to go along. They could profit considerably by watching an old trail hand in action. When I saw the packs RB and Charlie showed up with, I almost had to laugh. Neither pack was large enough to carry much more than a cheese sandwich. I carried more bicarbonate of soda than they had food. I didn't know what they planned to sleep in, but it certainly wouldn't be those tiny little tote bags they had perched on the top of their packs. Anyway, I didn't say anything. I just smiled and got out my winch, and they each got a pull, and before you knew it, we had my pack on out of the car and on my shoulders. As we headed up on the trail, I knew it was going to be a rough trip. Already a few flakes of snow had fallen on my eyeballs. The environment on that trip was even harsher than I had remembered. The trails were steeper, the air thinner, the ground harder, the nights colder. Even my trail speed was slower. Several porcupines shot past me like I was standing still. RB and Charlie showed obvious signs of relief when I made it into camp that first night. You probably thought I wouldn't make it with all that food, I chided them. No, RB said. It was just that for a moment there, we didn't recognize you. We thought we were being attacked by a giant snail. I explained to them that we, old-time backpackers, had made a practice of traveling the last mile or so on our hands and knees in order to give our feet a rest. It was disgusting to see them sitting there so relaxed and cheerful after a hard day's hike. They didn't seem to have any notion at all of what backpacking was about. I could hardly stand it when they whipped out a little stove and boiled up some dried chunks of leather and sponge for supper. It probably would have hurt their feelings if I'd got out the slab of bacon, so I didn't mention it. I just smiled and ate their food, 4 helpings, in fact, just to make my act convincing. I never told them, but the roast baron of beef was not quite rare enough for my taste, and they had forgotten the cream sauce for the asparagus tips. And I have certainly tasted better baked Alaska in my day, too. Well, they can have their fashionable new school backpacking if they want it. I'm sticking with the old way. Oh, I'm making a few concessions to a harsher environment, but that's all. When I got back from my trip, I did order a new pack frame. It was designed by nine aeronautical engineers, 3 metallurgists, and a witch doctor, and weighs less than the down of a small thistle. My new sleeping bag weighs 9 ounces, including the thermostatic controls. If I want to sleep in it, my new cook kit gets up and puts out the coffee. Then I bought a few boxes of that dried leather and sponge, but that's all. I'm certainly not going to be swept along on the tides of fashion. All right, well, we got a good one on that one. I hope you guys could understand it through my dying of hysterics and laughter. Good one to get for an Easter morning. And for you guys, I think this one will be live on Thursday. So let's stick with McManus. He can still deliver. All right, you guys, appreciate you tuning in.
If you have a question, topic, or guest that you'd like to hear about, log on to iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Rate the podcast, and in the review, leave your question, topic, or guest suggestion. Any questions posted will be answered at the beginning of the next recorded podcast. Topics and guest suggestions will be considered and pursued. Additionally, the rating will help the podcast grow. You can further support the podcast by logging on to the Stalker Stickbows website and purchasing a Western Bowhunter podcast t-shirt or window sticker from the Stalker store. Thanks for your support. I come down from the mountain.